like purple splashed on green. My soul is strangely fed through the winding hills ahead, and she plays a melody.
Non-Oscar watchers, you have good taste to be tuned into the radio. You can always watch the Oscars. What I saw so far was incredibly boring, and it occurs, and this is not a repeat of last week's show with the lovely Catherine O'Connell singing. This is a new show, an encore appearance for the one and only Catherine O'Connell.
Lucky me.
I know, lucky you, and we're going to spend this whole hour with you and Mary Pat Kelly. We'll get Mary Pat, the great writer and novelist, on in a second. Do you care about the Oscars at all?
I have not seen one movie.
Well, that will be something that will not induce you to turn it on and watch the thing.
Right.
But what occurs to me, you're a professional entertainer. These people are all professional movie makers. If you were nominated, and you may well be one day, Catherine, if you were nominated for an Academy Award, and even if among the four or five or eight people in your category, if you thought, oh, I have no chance whatsoever, but I want to go. I want to go to the Oscars. Wouldn't you prepare some kind of speech that was like, I have to thank so-and-so and so. You would have something prepared, wouldn't you?
Oh, I'd have to.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd just be stumped.
Well, that's kind of what stunned me about tonight. It's like, maybe some of the bigger award people will do it, but even if you're nominated for, like, sound editing, you would have some kind of prepared remarks. What awards have you won?
Awards?
Yeah. You must have won some.
Let me see.
Greatest Irish singer in the history of Chicago?
Yeah, but that was from you.
Okay, well. Yes. Or from Lyle Dean.
Or Lyle, yeah.
For those of you who are long-time listeners to this program, when Catherine first appeared on the morning iteration of my radio show, which was on for many, many years, the newsman for that show was a genius named Lyle Dean, who absolutely, the first time he heard and saw Catherine O'Connell, fell head over heels for you.
God, did
he
not? So full of malarkey. No, we became good friends. I was friends with his wife and everything else. So, yes, we're friends.
You've recently seen Lyle.
I did. Down in Florida, living the life.
What kind of life? He's got a boat. He's always at a boat, hasn't he?
Yes. Yep. It was fun, but we didn't go out on his boat.
How is he doing? I think he has a lot of fans out there, Catherine.
Oh, he was doing great. We had a great time. We met for lunch the day my girlfriend and I came in, and my girlfriend, who lives down near Naples, they talked boats, and so he was very happy to talk about trips they'd taken on boats and stuff like that. He was, you know, over the moon. Loved it.
I hope you gave him my best.
I did.
He used to, in such dramatic fashion during the first years or so of that morning radio show, he would intone, because I once said, wow, Lyle, this is my second show. He would intone, and now with the third edition of, or the fourth edition of, and someone wrote us a nasty note once saying, wait a minute. I think it was what we did. And now the fifth edition of the morning papers, the Sunday papers with Rick Kogan. And we got the nastiest note from people, from some guy saying, you know, you two are the most pretentious guys on the radio. There are guys who do five shows a week. And we thought, oh, boy, I'm glad he's doing well.
Yeah.
You were on again, dear, to talk and to be joined by the one and only Mary Pat Kelly. Mary Pat, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Where are you?
The two of you.
Where are you?
Hi.
Where are you?
I'm in New York.
That's where you live.
In New York, but heading your way. I live in New York, yes.
But Chicago is where you were born and raised.
Right. I always say, I live in New York, but I'm from Chicago. I'm a Chicagoan.
And you've got, with Catherine, a bunch of things. You're going to be on for the entire hour to talk about all of your writing and about these shows. Catherine explained a bit last week on the show. This is her encore performance, or her audition for the co-hosting role of the show. How you two came to be, and how you formed what is an increasingly popular, should I call it an act, Mary Pat?
I think it is an act. Yes, it's we're vaudeville. We're bringing back vaudeville.
It's because we're a couple of posers.
Now, what's your memory?
We had our best tribute when we walked into your studio a couple of years ago through that blizzard, and you said, "Here come two tough Irish broads." So that's what we are.
I said that.
Yes, you did.
I called you broads.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yes,
tough Irish broads.
Well,
tough
Irish broads. In the nicest way. The nicest way.
I only use that word in the nicest way, accompanied by many tender adjectives. What's your memory of your first meeting with Catherine O'Connell?
It was really interesting. Actually, Catherine just sang at the funeral of the woman who introduced us, Peg Reed. It was at the Irish Heritage Center, and Peg said, "You two, get together, figure out how you're going to do this." Remember, Catherine, we sat on the steps, on the back steps, which you're so like, because it was a school, you have a feeling you're in school.
Right.
And we clicked immediately. And, of course, I knew her singing, and I was so honored that she would join me up there. And we just figured it out. And from the very beginning, we had a chemistry. And, of course, we both love Chicago. We love Irish music. We love to tell our stories. And then our finale nowadays is I discovered when I was in Ireland that we actually are distant cousins.
No.
Absolutely. It was the wildest thing. I was in Carna, and the Connollys are from the townland just over. That's Catherine's mother's family.
Yeah.
Kilcarran. And so I was asking around, you know, who knew them. And so finally, they brought me to this man that had all the lore. And I was trying to explain what Connolly's. And I said, "Well, she's a beautiful singer." And he said, "Well, all the Connolly's sing." But anyway, we finally narrowed it down. And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "The Keeleys married into the Connolly's." So I said, "Yay, it worked. We're cousins."
Yeah.
One of the other things that distinguishes you two is your love and affection for history, and not just the Irish history of Chicago, but history in general. That is what's fueled, Catherine, your singing, and what fuels Mary Pat Kelly, your writing. The latest novel is Irish Above All. Have you read it yet, Catherine?
I have not.
You're going to have to get quick. When are you coming to town, Mary Pat Kelly?
Wednesday. So
okay.
She'll speed
She's got a couple it. Days. She's got a couple days. Yeah. I'm keeping her up late, but she's got a couple days. We got to take a break, but I'm keeping you you lovely ladies on for the entire hour so we can cover everything. You know, the Irish Above All, instead of, because my father was a historian, it's an incredibly meaningful book to me, and on the eve of a mayor election, a very important book for the city of Chicago, too. So please stay on the line, Mary Pat, and we'll be back momentarily. I will tell you first that the Red Hot Hawks are hoping this game's not tonight. When it comes to the weather, we all want to know, what did Skilling say? Watch for updated forecasts from Chicago's most trusted meteorologist Tom Skilling, weeknights on WGN-TV. We'll be right back.
Like midnight on the water, like the sun shines in the trees, like a summer morning up, the dawning shimmering in the breeze, like the crimson skies when the evening dies and brings me to my knees. And you're just another form in nature's fantasies. And if I had a mansion,
welcome back. We just had a lovely critique of the singing of Catherine O'Connell by Ernie Scatton, the engineer on this show, saying that if he was making a new Robin Hood movie, he would have Catherine singing the soundtrack, and thereby allowing you to win an Academy Award. When you were growing up in Chicago, Mary Pat Kelly, joining us from New York and coming to Chicago Wednesday for a series of events of which we will tell you about. Tell me a little about your childhood here.
Well, I said I'm bicultural or tricultural because I started out on the South Side and then we moved to Oak Park and ended up on the north side. So I kind of experienced all the neighborhoods. And I grew up very proud of being Irish with a name like Kelly.
Yes.
But I didn't really have any connection to Ireland itself. Ireland was like this mythical place. And it was the first Irish song I learned was Cheer, Cheer for Old Notre Dame. But it wasn't until 1969 when I made my first trip to Europe, saved $500 and set out with my friend backpacking, that we didn't even plan to go to Ireland because it would be like going to Shangri-La. Our first stop was in London, and we tried to rent a room in this woman's house. And when we arrived and we told her our names, Mary Pat Kelly, Mary Beth O'Hara, and she said, "You're Irish." And we said, "Yes, we're Irish. Isn't that wonderful?"
Do we get
and
a
she
discount?
Slammed the door in our face. She wouldn't rent us.
Really?
And we were shocked. Right.
I'll bet.
Because growing up in Chicago, of course, it was wonderful to be Irish. But she raised my consciousness. And we saw an ad in the paper for a cheap trip to Dublin because they were waiting for Godot, the special performance Peter O'Toole. And we took off. And when I got there, I fell in love. And I realized that there was more to being Irish than turning the river green on St. Patrick's Day. There was this amazing culture, the kindness of the people, the music. And it started me on a lifelong journey. So, growing up.
Go ahead.
Go on.
No, go ahead, honey.
No, but growing up, we didn't, the whole thing of Irish dancing and the Irish festivals, that came in later. I mean, I graduated from high school in 1962, so it was before all of that. You notice now in the generations, people name their children with Irish names. There's Brendan and Siobhan and Sinead. That didn't happen in my generation.
Interesting.
Proud of being Irish, but it was Chicago Irish.
Yeah, there's a real difference. And Catherine O'Connell and I have talked plenty over the years about, that explosion around St. Patrick's Day where they kiss me, I'm Irish, and indeed the dyeing of the river green and sort of turning this incredible kind of heritage into some kind of amusement park for a day.
A drunken
amusement park for a day. When did you had a very interesting career. I mean, you were in the movie biz for a while. And I've written about that, too. I saw your buddy in the subject of one of your books, two of your books, Martin Scorsese, in a commercial for Rolex during the early portion of the
I know. It was interesting. He's the one that's writing on the legal pad with a fountain pen.
Right.
Yeah. It was interesting because when I came back from Ireland, my family had moved to New York. My father was in advertising, so his job had moved him to New York. And I had come to know Scorsese through correspondence while I was in the convent. That's the kind of life I've had, all kinds of wonderful, like sitting on the stairs with Catherine O'Connell. And he was just exploring his Italian-American heritage because in 1969, 1970, young people weren't looking back at their own heritage. It was about being American. I mean, your favorite movie is John Ford.
Sure.
And he was very excited about the fact that I was discovering these layers of my own Irish identity and really encouraged me to go forward. And I went to NYU Film School. And through that, I worked in television in New York. But Ireland always came into it. When I was working for Good Morning America, I met John Hume. We tried to get him on the show. He would go on to win the Nobel Prize, but at that time, no one knew who he was, and they weren't interested in moderate voices. It's like you said, if you play to the stereotype, it's okay, but when you try to say something more nuanced and sensible and...
It doesn't fit the
narrative.
It doesn't fit the cultural narrative or the popular narrative. I mean, Catherine too fights that. I think that's one of the important things. What you two do together is wildly, from what I've heard, and I know you both pretty well, wildly entertaining. But there is a great deal also of substance in it, isn't it, Catherine?
I think so. Found the last time we had really great response, and people really enjoyed both the balance between the music and the stories and stuff like that, and the history. And I think people really did enjoy it.
Well, I also think that
what you said before about your dad, I use his books as my research. In fact, one of his books on Big Bill Thompson, it's in the rare book section of the City Library of New York City Library. And up at City College, and I was up there reading it,
proud to hear that. Yeah,
isn't
that's
wonderful?
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what he does in his books is what inspires me to, he makes it human, that they come across as real human beings. Because I think sometimes when you say history, people think of dates and generals and battles, but all of our ancestors lived through all these eons and all these upsets and everything, and they're the ones that can put a human face on it. And I think what Catherine and I try to do is we love the lighthearted part of the Irish eyes can smile. That's a great thing. But we want to give the deeper substance because it's an amazing story. And in this book, the Chicago history, what was done, I mean, the turning the lakefront into this beautiful, and it was all done for a reason. It was done so that people, regular people, could go out and live lives. I mean, the planetarium and the aquarium and Buckingham Fountain, those were not just done as some kind of monuments. Those were done to bring people out of very difficult and desperate circumstances to have a life,
Irish. As both of you well know, I'm myself being half Irish and mother's side being a Kavanaugh, the times that you write about, city living was anything but pleasant. And the reason that parks were built was so that people living in tenements and people working in the stockyards and people working in these musty, sort of overbearing kind of environments in factories could have some place to breathe.
Right. I found that the whole Burnham plan and the boulevards and everyone should have a park, some sort of park that they could walk to in their neighborhood. And I just find that is so forward-thinking and beautiful and everything. And it's part of one of the good things that came out of the city being razed by fire is that it could be rebuilt in a really beautiful plan.
Well, it seems, I mean, given, you know, the nature of longtime Chicago politics, it seems wonderfully and weirdly altruistic to do that. It also, no doubt that it helped increase the land values around various parts. In your latest book, Mary Pat, and we'll get into it a little more in depth, you focus on one of the great underrated, fascinating political figures in the history of this town who really did have history kind of thrust upon him. You're following your famous, I would call her famous, Nora Kelly and her adventures, but she also happens to be the cousin of a mayor of the city of Chicago named her cousin is Ed Kelly, who was sort of had history thrust upon him by a botched assassination, correct?
Absolutely. And I have her as the photographer. The first lines of the book are, I saved Franklin Roosevelt's life and killed the mayor of Chicago with two words, move closer. She's taking the picture of Cermak and Roosevelt when the assassin fires and Mrs. Roosevelt and hit Cermak, and Kelly is put in as mayor strictly because he had been the builder. He was president of the South Park. He was the chief engineer. He'd supervised Soldier Field. He'd gotten financing. He'd saved the Museum of Science and Industry. That original building was supposed to be torn down, and he'd led a campaign to save it. So, and also, altruistic, and they were all jobs, too. I mean, construction was always, you know, it was, but he had a real love for Chicago, and he was thrust into a situation where the city was going bankrupt. 20,000 teachers had just marched on City Hall because they hadn't been paid for 3 months. I mean, they're talking about the government shutdown 10 days. The people, the city workers in Chicago hadn't been paid for months, and the teachers kept on teaching, and he stepped into that. But because he had formed a good relation with the business people. He got people to pay their taxes. And because Roosevelt respected him, he was able to get a lot of federal money in. And like you say, he has been forgotten, I think, because of overshadowed by Daley. But in his day, he was a very powerful person and brought a lot of things to Chicago.
And one of the other great things about him is, you know, given that Anton Cermak is the guy who was the main architect of what became the potent Democratic political machine, he kept it alive. We got to take a little commercial break. We're on with Mary Pat Kelly, novelist, and Catherine O'Connell, songstress, and we'll be back after the news.
As I'm sitting all alone in the gloaming, it might have been that I watched the fisher's sails all roaming to the little herring fleet at anchor lay.
I must tell you, folks, that the singing of Catherine O'Connell, and that is she, has inspired the show's talented engineer, Ernie Scan, to all sorts of creative leaps here. He sees people on a hillside listening to her music, and you think of John Denver. On the phone, Catherine is in the studio. On the phone with us is Mary Pat Kelly, who arrives back in her hometown of Chicago on Wednesday for more than a week of events. Some are a book talk, it's going to meet the author stuff, and many of them are collaborations with Catherine O'Connell, all in honor of her latest book, which is called Irish Above All. It is it's a continuation of what is now a trilogy, Galway Bay, followed by Of Irish Blood, and now Irish Above all firmly, firmly grounded in solidly researched history. You obviously, Mary Pat Kelly, love to do research.
I do. And I am very lucky because I have actually met a lot of the people that are characters. I mean, I remember meeting Ed Kelly when I was a little kid. I remember driving into the big house in Eagle River, Wisconsin. And there's all these wonderful coincidences. His second wife, his first wife died in the flu epidemic, and then his 13-year-old son died when he was of a ear infection when he was away at school. Yeah. But his second wife, Margaret Kelly, was from Kansas City. And so I'm able to weave her story in with the Century of Progress and the famous Sally Rand, who was also from Kansas City.
Yes, and then naked with big feathered fans. Yes.
Feathered fans, yes. And then also the Kansas City connection with Harry Truman, where Kelly and the other city bosses chose Harry Truman to be the vice president. And so I've met enough of the real people. In fact, at one point, my Aunt Marge, who of course knew all these people and just died 2 years ago, I got a little nervous because I kind of fictionalized some of the things, especially Nora. And I said to my Aunt Marge, I said, you know, I gave Aunt Noni this boyfriend, and she said Aunt Noni had a lot of boyfriends. So I'm feeling that I was getting some... exactly. Some of the human side of the things, but I do love the research. And in this book, I was able to do the Chicago, the getting FDR's third term, the famous voice from the sewer when Ed Kelly engineered a demonstration that had the convention nominate him for a third term, though, as supposedly Franklin Roosevelt said to Ed Kelly, I can't run for a third term. George Washington only did two. And Kelly said to him, George Washington couldn't be elected precinct captain in Chicago. So
you also, but, I, the thing and then, the thing about Irish Above All is it covers years that are not devoid of interesting people and or events. The Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, World War II, Joe Kennedy, Big Bill Thompson, Al Capone, Mussolini, and all number of people. I know that you and Catherine O'Connell are two of the most brightest and most ebullient women that I know. In doing your collaborative events, and you can go to, it's a very, very, very good website, marypatkelly.com. You get a great, is it a biographical sketch of Mary Pat? You can read about all of her books, and you can see in detail this upcoming schedule that starts this coming Friday at the Evergreen Park Library, a nice library, without Catherine. When you two are together, what is the nature of the show? I know, Catherine, you've described it, but you're both great talkers. You're both such compelling characters. How does it? Do you rehearse beforehand?
No. Most of the time, I leave the talking to Mary Pat. As you can see, she's well able to handle all of that. And every once in a while, she'll ask for like the story of my grandfather, how her. Whoever that Shaunakee or whatever that guy was, figured out that we were related. There's a story about my grandparents being in Galway City, and my grandpa didn't wake up for breakfast. Mm. And so my grandma went down and had her breakfast on her own, thinking he always having a lion. And she goes back upstairs, and he still wasn't awake, and she couldn't wake him up, and she called the manager. And he took one look at my grandpa and said, "He won't be waking up today, Mrs. Conley." So he died in his sleep, you know. And the guy that Mary Pat was talking to said, "Oh, that Conley."
That Conley, right. He couldn't until I told the story, and he said, "Oh, that Conley." But yeah. The wonderful thing about Catherine is, you know, she sings from the heart.
Oh,
and,
no question.
Ernie Skattinger
is ready to be her manager, yeah.
Right, exactly. And she told, I mean, she knows the history of these stories. For example, now I'm telling her stories, but she tell about Danny Boy, why the pipes are calling, Catherine.
Well, there's so many stories about it, but the one that I use when I get preparing to sing it is that an agent would go through the country and sell tickets, and the way you would know that your ship was coming in was a piper would go along at playing a certain tune from the hills, and that's how you would know that it was time to make your way and have the American wake and make your way to Cove in Cork or wherever the ship was leaving from.
Oh, interesting. There must be...
The pipes are calling, because if the landlord knew you were leaving, they'd take the money. They would take your ticket. But so we try to give some background of the song. Like in this time, since we are doing World War II, and there were 300,000 American troops in Northern Ireland during World War II.
Wow.
And they... Yeah, 300,000, and it's kind of an untold story, but at the time, the first soldiers that went into Europe went to Northern Ireland to train for the invasion of Europe.
Sure.
So the number one song on the hit parade in 1943 was "Johnny Doughboy Found a Rose in Ireland," and it's the story how he meets an Irish girl, and he makes an American beauty of this Irish rose.
Oh,
so you can imagine how beautiful it's going to be when Catherine sings it. Yeah,
yeah, when Catherine learns it.
Yeah,
hey, you only got two. You got 2 days.
You got two days.
Well, you have more than 2 days.
Our first big performance is at the Irish Heritage Center.
Back to the scene of the crime.
A week from today, duo was born. We got to take a little break. We'll come back and finish off this lovely, lovely interview with these two talented women, Mary Pat Kelly, that's marypatkelly.com, and Catherine O'Connell, that's catherineoconnell.com with no apostrophe. Welcome back. Please go to marypatkelly.com, where you can not only read about this talented Chicago native who has become an extremely talented novelist. Do you feel better with every book, Mary Pat? Do they ever get easier for you? The third of your novels is Of Irish Blood, which you'll be celebrating with a week plus. plus of activities in Chicago. Does it get easier?
Well, the next book is going to be shorter, I'll tell you that.
You said that about this one, Mary Pat.
I feel it's a great privilege. Yeah, I know it. I know it. It's an honor because, you know, I'm like you and Catherine. We love Chicago. We love the history. We love our families. And through this work, I'm able to see them in a kind of a more three-dimensional way.
Well, that's lovely.
I know I've mentioned about the my father's cousin who was a BVM nun. Sister Mary Aragina lived to be 107. And she gave me a lot of the family stories. And when I was starting this book, I found some letters from her, and one of them told where all the bodies were buried, but literally what cemetery they were in. And at the very end, she told, and I used it for the title of the book, she said, "Granny Honora always believed we would see Ireland after we died. We are Americans, yes, Chicagoans, of course, but Irish above all."
Wow.
So I felt that I wanted to really bring not only, and I think what the great thing about writing these books is when I go on these book tours, people come up to me from every ethnic background and say, this is our story.
The story of my family.
Because exactly. And it's often a woman that was determined that their family would live, that their children would have a better life. And that's what really motivates me, because I think people don't, I wish every person would look into their family story, because everybody has drama. They have tragedy. They have triumph. We wouldn't be here if these people hadn't survived enormous things. So,
well, enormous things, yes. They survive in a daily in one day more than most of us have survived in a lifetime.
Exactly.
You are doing, in essence, then, at these many things, you're coming here to celebrate the publication of Irish Above All, and your other three books, but the gist of what you two do together is to honor and entertain. Right, Catherine?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And encourage, because if they can do it, and to realize that we all have this enormous potential, and it's thrilling, really. And then to have people come and enjoy, and with Catherine, I can watch their faces while she sings. People cheer up, they laugh, they applaud. It's a connection. It's a soul to soul, heart to heart connection that is really nourishing, especially in these trying times. No, I see the faces. It's wonderful. It's a great experience to be part of, because I think music communicates in a way that words don't. It's a soul to soul connection. It goes right to the heart, especially the way Catherine sings.
Well, I know reading's a visceral thing, but music is an immediately visceral thing. You know
immediate.
What I mean?
Yeah. But Catherine has a special quality. I react. I can feel, my body reacting, getting chills, getting goosebumps. I'm not thinking about it. It comes right in from her heart. It's an amazing experience.
It's a nice thing to hear.
And it's what has let the Irish survive. It's why the Irish have survived, because they were able to do that. And music was the tool of survival, not just for the Irish, for many cultures.
Sure.
But we're really lucky to have her.
Well, Chicago's lucky to have the two of you. I saw that happen with Ernie Skatton here. I'm dead serious when he was listening to Catherine sing. And I, who have read your first two novels, and I'm halfway through your third, I get that kick, too. I mean, you are both. You two are an amazing team. Do you both feel in the couple minutes we have left, because I want to end this show with some of Catherine singing, you must feel, Catherine, pretty fortunate to have made this team on the back stairs of the Irish American Heritage Center.
I remember, Mary Pat, you sent me a galley of Galway Bay, and when I finished it, we talked, and I told you, as I finished it, I mean, it was so overwhelming, and I thought to myself, boy, I better get my acting gear, because a lot of people suffered through a lot of stuff for me to be here in my little house.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Catherine. That's what we all better be happy, Rick, because people went through a lot for us just to be here. And you're right, Catherine. That's just how I feel. And I think doing it in Chicago, we're telling people who lived through it. I mean, people know these people, particularly now that we're up into, World War II and more contemporary. It goes all the way up to Kennedy. So people will know.
first Irish Catholic president.
as we all
remember and know. You two are really something. It is an ongoing treat and honor to know both of you.
Oh, thanks. You can get more information. Thank you.
Catherine O'Connell has a ton of CDs in her basement.
Unless Ernie's going to think about wanting to get her address
and go steal them all.
Ernie, you should come to the Union League Club. You know, that's right downtown.
You're right. That's a week from Friday at the Union League Club. That's a great place for this event. CatherineO'Connell.com with no apostrophe and MaryPatKelly.com. You can get all
and
the information.
Now my husband, Martin, even gave me a Facebook page, Mary Pat Kelly, the number two. Wow. Mary Pat Kelly, too.
I'm sure it would be, because I'm sure there wasn't a Mary Pat Kelly on Facebook. That's another great thing about the Irish. Mary Pat, I can't wait to see you when you get here. You arrive Wednesday.
Can't wait to see you, Rick. Thank you so much. You have no idea how much your encouragement means to us. Thank you.
It means a lot to me,
too. Oh, yeah,
too.
And I talked to for the concert for Saturday night, and they sold, I don't know, like 50 tickets from last week. So thank you very much for that.
Now they'll sell out. We are going to, in honor of both you, Catherine, and of you, Mary Pat, and of newest fan, Ernie Scatton, we're going to close off this hour with Catherine O'Connell singing. Thank you, ladies. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thank you.
I see the light across the bay.
No, that's Seamus O'Kane.
I see the light not far away, and I hear music.
That's the Parting Glass.
All around.
Yeah.
I'm getting.
When we do the chorus. So that, it's that nice harmony. That,
oh, all the money that e'er I've spent, I have spent it in good company. And all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, it was to none but me. And all I've done for want of wit, to memory now I can't recall. So fill to me the parting glass. Good night and joy be with you all. Oh, all the sweethearts that e'er I've known, they are sorry for my gone away. And all the comrades that e'er I've had, they'd wish me one more day to stay. But as it falls unto my lot that I should rise and ye should not, well, I'll gently rise then and softly call. Good night and joy be with you all.
Oh, honey, it was great. I was talking to Catherine O'Connell. Oh, honey, it was great, meaning her encore appearance on this show. Please stay tuned for a couple of women coming in here to tell what I find a compelling, riveting, frightening, but ultimately hopeful and inspiring story about a woman. Title of the book, In Deep, How I Survived Gangs, Heroin, and Prison to Become a Chicago Violence Interrupter. It's quite a story. Stay tuned. Reread for the second time a book called In Deep, How I Survived Gangs, Heroin, and Prison to Become a Chicago Violence Interrupter. I looked up the name of the author in the Tribune to see what we had done as far as a book review of a very important book co-written by Linda Begstrom, and found nothing. And I find that incredibly shameful. This is not only a hugely important book, and not only are you pronounce your name for
Angelia me. Bianca. Hence, everyone calls me Bianca.
Of course they do.
It's Angelia.
And Linda Beckstrom is here, too. Linda, let me ask you first. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved? Had you known?
Well, I always say she walked into my front door. I host a writing workshop twice a year in my house, and it's taught by Pamela DeBar, who wrote
sure.
I'm with the Band. And Bianca and Pamela met in L.A., and Pamela said, you should come to my workshop next time. And so Bianca did. And it was an amazing meeting because not only did we sort of have a connection right off the bat, I mean, we're both Italian, we're both Sicilian, mm-hmm. there was kind of a little bond there, but in the course of the workshop, we learned a lot about her life. And it was shocking.
It
and,
is on you know. Some level, and I'll tell you yeah. this too, Bianca, that it, on some level it's almost surreal. The notion that you are a survivor is amazing to me, because even we're of roughly the same generation mm-hmm. and open to various seductions that you fell to, and some of my friends did, and some of my friends mm-hmm. did not make it through. You are from a relatively stable Italian family, relatively upper middle class. They own Gene and Jude's. You're doing well. Your mother, I'm not a psychologist, and I don't play one on radio or in print, but your mother left when you were young for a while, and that seemed to throw you a bit,
me.
Even as a child, a bit off kilter. that's the way I read it in the book. Yes?
Yeah. At a five-year-old me, I would not know of what was going on or
sure.
happening, right?
Sure.
So all I knew is that my mother left. It's burnt in my image of her leaving, right? And then I really didn't know why, and it was kind of like I was very close to my mother, and I didn't know a lot of things were going on. I was 5 years old. But anyway, but as time went by...
But you do know. You do know your mom's not
know.
There anymore.
Well, yeah. And
right.
my grandmother, and it was kind of like nobody talked about it, and I didn't see her, and I remember like by the time I was maybe like 7, and we were living in Little Italy, and my grandmother's... my family owned a building there. So she had an apartment. It was all family in Little Italy. And... I remember getting a package of these beautiful dolls, and I think they came from New York or something, and it was just like real mysterious, and I really didn't really know. No one really said anything, but the thing is that then later found out that, you know, it was like marital problems between my mom and dad. And then I think I did hold a grudge because I was 5. My sister was only 1. But I loved my mother so much. And for a long time after that, I remember sitting on the radiator in our old-fashioned apartment in Little Italy, staring out the window. And I remember my legs would be hot, burning from the radiator. My grandmother would go, no, put a pillow there. And I wouldn't leave. I'd go, no, I'm waiting for my mother, you know. And I often thought about that later in life, when I could picture my own children sitting by a window saying, while they're waiting for a mother to come home that was never going to come home.
Yeah, there are these circles. And Linda, get in on this one. You know, I have no list of 10 questions. It's
a sort of
series of, you know, did you then, and we will get the entire story during this hour, but we're going to flit around. Mm-hmm. Did you then, you probably were too high and messed up then to realize that was in a sense what you were doing to your 5, count them, children. At the time, you couldn't have been, it couldn't have been, ooh, this cycle, you were looking for a fix. You were
right. I think that one thing that comes out in the book is just, I mean, Bianca's incredibly honest about not blaming anyone or trying to find some big answer. She liked the life, and
yeah.
she liked having a good time.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, I've many times said, there but for the grace of God. I mean, we all had those temptations.
Oh,
you know?
It's of an era. I mean,
right.
when you go to work at the Board of Trade, I go, oh my God, this is
of course,
this is the
everywhere.
Worst thing you could do.
It's literally under your nose.
This is the worst thing you could do.
Yeah.
Literally under your nose.
Let me ask you, you must have gotten gotten high initially around 10 years old.
Nine. My friend.
I was only off by a year.
Yeah, my friend. And actually, yesterday, I was with my daughter, Ashley, at her house, and she just had a baby. And I was seeing my new grandson, Lincoln. And we were talking because my granddaughter is 10. And she was like, Mom, how I can't even imagine. And I'm like, Ashley, listen, I just want you to know it's been rough because it's, I mean, I've been clean almost 9 years now, right?
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Yay.
Yeah.
I never would have believed I could go a day. But anyway, I just stopped getting high and like everything came back to me. I had to work really hard and I had to really accept that everyone recovers in their own time, even though I kicked into gear and I'm an okay person now and I'm going to do the right thing. But I had to accept that my kids may never talk to me again.
Wasn't it true? I mean, before you started to get clean, you were totally estranged from your kids.
Completely. I didn't see anybody in my family for almost 17 years.
Your aunt was the only one who wrote to you in prison.
That's right.
I'm just trying to prove to these nice, interesting ladies that I did.
Because
Bianca's the first thing she said. I go, it's an amazing book. She goes, you read it? I go, yeah, I read it. Yeah, I read it.
So appreciate look at all these that, notes. Rick.
Yeah. But,
oh, no, it's such a... And Linda, you're a
brilliant writer.
You're a great, great writer.
Yeah.
You know, and I want to... We'll talk... Well, we got the whole hour. I want to talk about, you know, collaboration is a... It's a weird dance between subject and author. There has to be an incredible amount of trust involved in that.
Really clicked really well, but I just want to finish what you were saying about the getting high at nine and what I often refer to.
How'd you get high? What?
Morphine. I didn't know it was morphine at the time, but my friend Keith, who was like, you know, we were all our little clique, and his father was dying of cancer.
And so he had
the bright idea, like, because we were already, like, standing in front of, years ago, your co-radio guy here. What is your name?
Ernie.
He's too young. But there used to be a national grocery store on Harlem right off of, like, Randolph or something.
Uh-huh.
I can't even imagine when I was nine, me and my little friend standing out in front and saying, waiting for each person, hey, can you buy us a bottle of Boone's Farm wine? And they would buy it for us,
sure.
Right? And so... anyway, so we would take the pills, and we liked the feeling. You know, we got high, and I remember, my friend's mother, Wanda, was so dramatic, like my grandma, wild Sicilian woman, right? And so, like, when she would catch us, and she would know what we were doing, and we were, like, considered, like, you know, these...
juvenile delinquents,
you know? Juvenile delinquents, and she'd be like screaming at us and chasing us out the house, and we didn't care. And then Forest Park Liquors, not to throw them under the bus, but but and I don't
it's a think, long time ago. Don't worry.
So, but they used to deliver. I don't know if they still deliver or not. But they used to deliver. So this is like we're talking early 70s, right?
Yeah.
So me and my little friends, Carol and Katie and whatever, we'd be in Oak Park, and they had this really nice, like, you know, modest house. They had a big mansion, but it was like...
Well, it's Oak Park. Yeah.
Yeah, a nice house. And so her parents would be away for the... they had a resort.
Yes, hello, this
so
is
away.
Mrs. Jones.
So we would call on the phone and order whatever, a keg of beer, slow gin, the red one, because I remember I got really sick.
It
was a horrible scene. Anyway... But so we would have to think, how are we going to get this liquor when the man comes, right? So we came up with this idea, and of course I was always the one with the most guts, right?
Yeah, the ringleader.
Facilitator. I would be like, I got it, don't worry. Anyway, and so the door would ring, and then Katie, she was like real sweet little girl, you know, so cute, blonde hair, little Irish girl. Who's there? You know, Forest Park Liquors, is your mom here? Hold on, Mom! And then I'd be at the top of the stairs. I'd put Noxzema all over my face, and I'd put a towel around my head and her mother's robe, and I'd have a cigarette hanging out of my mouth with all the Noxzema. Yeah, who is it? And they'd say, Forest Park Liquors, ma'am.
Just give them the money.
Like, just put it on the floor. The money's on the table. Katie, give him the money. You know, and then you'd be like, okay. And I take the Noxzema off, pull it on.
Well,
one
of the things is that kind of theatricality, I think, in reading this fabulous book in deep is one of the things that helped you survive.
I think
years.
So, yeah.
I really do believe that. We've got to take a break. We'll be back on keeping Bianca and Linda here all the way till 11 o'clock. Chicago Knows Best, right? Hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's Best where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays, 10 o'clock. Stupidest commercial in the history of radio. Sundays at 10 on WGN TV. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Linda Beckstrom, who is an astonishingly talented writer, has put together the life story of my new friend, Bianca, who spent some 36 years or so, not just as a heroin addict, but, you know, fond of heroin, and 12 years in various jails, and countless, I cannot, Bianca, remember offhand the number of times you were arrested.
At least 125 times.
For a variety of things that all basically...
Most of them, the majority are misdemeanors because I lived in that era of, like, if you were on the corner, they got you for attempting to buy drugs or loitering or whatever.
Sure.
But a lot of them are
felonies. And stealing and kiting checks and stuff like that.
Yeah, though so, I've never killed or shot anybody. I just have to get this. So.
Well, there are very few.
Throw that out there.
There are probably mayoral candidates who can't say that. So using drugs and getting booze with your friends when you're a little kid, they weren't quite gateway drugs, but they gave you a taste of a certain kind of life, and you were kind of spoiled. Your dad,
he
still alive?
No, he passed away.
Your dad is a very strange man in this book. He comes, he's a womanizer, he's emotionally distant with you, but you were able, the family was successful enough that you, if you wanted a car, you got a car, right?
Yeah, my father loved me, and my whole family did, and I know my father loved me, I just don't think that he had the skills. He wasn't really the father type, you know what I mean? But and I don't think he kind of I don't know, but I know that my grandmother, when she died, I know she died of a broken heart, and I have to live with that now, and I only can hope that she's looking down from heaven and it could finally.
Well, you dedicate the book to her, your aunt too, Aunt Louise, who is the one who is the only one when you were in jail
who kept
she wasn't like an enabler. She wrote me every week and sent me pictures of my kids. Otherwise, I honestly.
Well, that's not enabling.
Like.
I think.
No. I'm talking about like she wasn't like the aunt, like sending me tons of money, but she did send me $10 a month, and so the little $10 a month was so I could buy a bag of coffee every 2 weeks because she knows I like coffee. But I love my Aunt Louise so much, and she's still alive. And my Uncle Joe, my father's brother. He's like beyond proud, my Uncle Michael. I'm just really grateful and humbled that, you know, I'm back with my family after so many years. We joked, we were in the house that I was thrown out of, and my uncle beat me up in front of the front lawn.
told
all the neighbors, if you see her here, call the police and have her arrested, and told the police. So, like, I couldn't even come by the house. So, but anyway, when I finally changed my life and I was at the house the first time, I was going, oh my God, can you believe? Because I had just came back from Obama's second inauguration. Yeah. I was an invited guest. Anyway, and so I was like, oh my God, Uncle Joey, can you believe that I was at the White House? And then my cousin says, I can't believe you're in this house.
I can't believe you're alive. One of the interesting things, much of the early part of the book starts with an incredible bang, so to speak, where you sort of save someone. I don't want to give too much away. And in saving that person, you were drawn back to the really dark times. And early on, it's kind of a playful kind of life. I mean, it's a life that
it was fun.
It's the Mart. It's the $1,000 to sleep with some goof at the Ambassador East Hotel. Yeah. It's traveling with rock bands. It's selling T-shirts. It's traveling all over the country. Mm-hmm. It's fun.
I was having a ball. I didn't think I needed anything at all. I was perfectly happy.
Well, and then at the beginning of chapter 3, and again, Linda Beckstrom, you are a very talented writer. The book has a really powerful narrative drive. You ask a friend, you're doing dope, aren't you? You say, yeah, I am, and it's horrible, your friend admits to you. I knew it. I want to try. I begged her. No way, she yelled. You already love barbiturates way too much. This is such a telling line in this book. If I let you try heroin, you're going to end up an addict and a hooker on Cicero Avenue back in Chicago. You then write, Linda, this is all in your voice, Bianca, she was so right it was prophetic, but I couldn't see any of that coming. I just wanted to know what it was like to get high on heroin. And initially was really...
Eventually, I did end up a hooker on Cicero Avenue.
Yeah. So. You know, a hooker, homeless, you name it, sleeping in... When you look back on some of this, Bianca, first, Linda, when you were hearing these stories, and I'm assuming this was hours of tape recording, at any time did you say... Jesus Christ, I cannot, I don't believe you. I can't believe you.
I can't ever say that I didn't believe her.
Right.
But what I did have trouble was putting the person in front of me.
Exactly.
Telling me this with this person she was talking about. And you know, when she told me about her life so many times.
Yeah.
And then there would be things when I'd say, okay, you're going to tell me that again when I record you.
Right.
And I just kept saying, your life makes no sense.
Exactly.
You should not be here. You should not be able to speak. You should not be, you know. And then even just getting sober and keeping it that way. But then the work that she does now.
We haven't even gotten to that. This is not someone who has written a book simply to write a book. It's because of what you do as a violence interrupter.
You know, I mean, spending her time going to meetings and keeping it together, and that's perfectly fine. A lot of people get by that way.
A McDonald's.
That's not what happens.
I know.
And that's not what she does with her life.
It's such a redemptive thing.
Yeah, I mean, writing it was... I mean, there were days, honestly, when I walked away from the keyboard just... Like my fingers were on fire.
Oh my God!
Like,
sure.
What was that? You know. But she has been an incredible inspiration to me. I mean,
well, she will. And this book is.
But I have to tell you, because this is like kind of really interesting. So, like, of course, Linda was very open and willing, and we were really close with this project, right? And she wanted to know my life, and I wanted her to know everything. So I said, Linda, for you to really understand, I have to bring you on a tour of the hood. We have to go on hood tours. And she was like, okay. And I was like, you're not going to be scared, right?
Yeah.
She was like,
come on, let's drive out to...
She was never scared.
Let's drive out to Madison and Cicero.
Oh, no, I was taking her worse than that.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and I'm like down rickety alleys, like with all potholes and like gang activity going on. And like, and so I was like, okay, Linda, don't be scared now. I know it's a rickety alley. She's like, no, I'm fine. And I'm pulling up and, you know, people are going, oh, Bianca, you know, they're coming to the car. Who's that? I'm like, oh, no, everything's fine. It's my co-author. She's helping me write my book, blah, blah. And so it was fine. But I, like, literally took her down alleys. This alley I OD'd in. This is where somebody saw someone shot. This is where I robbed a guy. I pickpocketed him and told him I was going to have sex with him, and I didn't. I'm not bragging about any of this either, too.
I know.
I'm just keeping it real. Right. And this is the McDonald's where I dyed my hair. This is where I stole from to... steal diapers for my baby. I mean, like, all this crazy
and
stuff.
And all of that was fascinating, but what was really interesting and enlightening was that I saw her become that person that relates to people in the community.
Oh, no question. Like, there's
instantly.
A language.
There's a, yeah.
We got to take a commercial, but we're going to continue on.
Amazing.
We could stay here for the next 8 hours, I think. We'll continue on with these two fascinating women. And the book, again, is called In Deep. You should buy it, no matter You should buy it because it's a great book, period. That music may be a little too buoyant for the show, except it is ultimately a story of survival and redemption. Bianca is the subject of In Deep, How I Survived Gangs, Heroin, and Prison to Become a Chicago Violence Interrupter, written with Linda Beckstrom. It is one of the most compelling books that I can remember reading. It is a story that will be familiar to anybody who has ever known anybody who has fallen prey, even for a minute. Even if your kid once smoked marijuana and said, "Hey, leave me alone, Dad," and didn't fall into the incredibly deep hole that Bianca did. And it was a deep hole. It involved 36 years of addiction, roughly a dozen years in jail, and many years in places worse than jail, living on the streets. You have to be not just tough, you have to be shrewd, you have to be sly. Resilient. What else do you have to be, Bianca?
Resilient.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I learned at a, I don't know, you know, like now that in my new life, I understand better about behavior, and I understand about trauma. And clearly, I was traumatized at the age of 4 when I was molested by an adult, and no one in my family, but a babysitter. And then at 5, and my mom left. And even though my mom came back eventually, and I spent every, weekend with her, and she remarried, and I have my sister Dina and my brother Rich and Joe. Those are her 3 children, my half siblings. And so everything was okay in the end. And then my father remarried to my wonderful stepmother Pat and had one more child, a son, Michael. And so, but in the beginning, it was just me and my sister Cricky.
Yeah.
And now looking back, yeah, clearly I had some type of trauma, right? But we didn't know about all that stuff in the 60s, right?
Well, but you also had, and I get the sense in the book, I mean, living on the streets is daily trauma. I mean, that is
hour by hour.
Yeah,
you were
in some kind of bizarre netherworld,
yeah,
where you really don't know what to expect. Where you, I assume, are always on edge and wary and watchful.
Yeah, of course. I think I just it became my norm, and I just kind of went with it. And I just didn't know that I could change. I figured that's my life.
Did you figure you had to figure at some point you were going to die?
I didn't even care if I did.
Yeah.
I mean, just to be clear, like, in the beginning, for a very long time, I mean, I still, even though there were some, like, problems and arrests and high school chases with police and gangbanging and all that stuff, but I still was having fun, right? But in the end, you end up alone, homeless, with nothing, hour by hour.
Just what your friend told you.
Yeah, so, like, towards the end, if I would sober up a little bit, I would start to remember a vision or a memory of my grandmother or my family or my kid. The guilt was too much for me to bear. That how could you walk out like on your children? You know what? You know, like horrible guilt. So I would try to get as high as I possibly could, because I just couldn't. I didn't know how to deal with that.
Well, Linda, you do an amazing job of dealing with that. You get out of prison at one point and you go to Safe Haven.
Yeah, I remember
when Nellie started Safe Haven, and it's an amazing place.
It is an amazing
place. But the first time you got out, it's like, boom, back.
Yeah, yeah. Because, hopefully it's changing, and I do try to work and be the voice. of policy change.
Sure.
And I work closely with a lot of legislators. If they ask my opinion or to testify or whatever to try to make things better. But I like to see, you know, prison reform as far as like more programs. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are going to say, oh, all these programs, you know, we have too many programs. But you know what? What do you, you know, like, you got a choice here, right? You got somebody getting out of prison. You could say, you know what? We got too many problems and we don't care. It's your problem. Figure it out.
Well, look,
you
know,
then that person's going to be a criminal
you
again.
You know better than most. My theory about prisons is they're racially motivated warehouses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For people
it's
nobody
horrible,
wants
yeah.
to see and they don't care anything about them.
I spent
considerable time with county
jails.
Yeah. Of course, because many of them are private across the country. Yeah. They're mostly privatized. Right. Yes. And let's put the people we don't want to see, in
them.
There
exactly.
for keeps.
The invisible
what
people.
You do now... You went back to Safe Haven. You begged to get into.
I begged to go back there. Oh my God! I like with tears in my eyes. I begged because I knew.
You knew this was the only life raft around.
Routine, right?
Yeah.
Because like as I was about to say before, like I'd wake up and I'd go get my dope. I'd be dope sick and I'd get my dope and then I'd be like I'd like look up into. To the sky and go, like, God, real, do we got to go through another day of this?
Yeah.
Like, I was never suicidal,
well,
but I didn't
things,
care. Like, when is this going to be over? You know, like, let's just end this, you know?
You got to take a break, and then I want to, you people will be able to read a story of mine in the Tribune certainly within the next month about this book, and you too. And I want to concentrate a little on what you're doing now, because there's just, you know, there are a lot of stories.
Yeah.
There are a lot. When you have a photo section in the middle that at one point has you backstage with Roger Daltrey, and then a few pages of photos later standing next to Rahm Emanuel, there's a story there. There's a big, big
That's
story
a journey.
There. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about how the book's been received, and it's got to be favorable. But look for a story of mine in the Tribune in the next month, certainly, because I'm terribly taken with the book, I'm terribly taken with the story, and we'll be back in a couple minutes. Fascinating book, In Deep, How I Survived Gang as Heroin and Prison to Become a Chicago Violence Interrupter, written with Linda Beckstrom. You can find this book on Amazon or anywhere else. And bookstores. I prefer bookstores. We have not touched upon what she does now, but I want to read, and it's not to... I think these two believe that I have read the book, because I'm mentioning...
Yeah, we know you have.
Yeah.
We believe you.
She talks about what is her life's work now, and she writes with the help... It is a story. It's a really wonderful collaboration you two have, because it really is... I don't know you that well, Bianca, but it's a very distinctive voice that you, Linda Beckstrom, have really captured, and that is a hard thing to do.
Thank you.
So you write, this is what I do to make the full weight of my own journey count for something positive. It's how I live. I know the streets, have experienced the violence, and understand the toll that drugs and bullets exact. Addiction and violence take away everything that feels human until they eventually take away lives. Every kid with a gun thinks he will win. Every addict believes he or she is above being consumed by drugs and can stay ahead of the wolves. I learned the hard way that neither is possible, but it took almost 36 years of my life. At the start of it all, I was a spoiled kid who thought she was invincible and the coolest thing ever to hit the street. I never believed the street would hit back and take everything from me. You are trying to teach the lessons of the street to people at risk. What do you do now, Bianca?
So I do whatever I can to help. My primary job is I work at the University of Illinois at Cure Violence. And
which used to be Ceasefire,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Ceasefire,
yeah.
Same thing. You know, over the years I was promoted. Now I actually do data and documentation, more elaborate stuff. But
you're out and about.
I still go out there. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I don't care if you make me the president of the University of Illinois. I could be the chancellor tomorrow, and I'd still be
out on the streets.
I have to go to Garfield now when I get off work, right?
Yeah.
So I still go on the streets. My primary is trying to intervene. You know, I have so many relationships on the streets. I kind of, you know, like I can identify on social media if some beef is getting out of hand, or potentially could go offline to a shooting or a killing. And you know, of course, you know, if I have the relationship, then I'll call. Well, I don't really do too much on the phone, but I'll like literally get in my car and go. I'm like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Right?
Let me ask you. You've been clean and sober for 9 years.
And on May 8th, it'll be 9 years.
9 years. When you go back out on the streets and you see people with whom you used to hang who are also surviving in their way, though not as well as perhaps you, it must be, in some level, really heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking for me to see even young people, because I know the path that they're going to go down.
Yeah.
Because they can't see it. But then it's also heartbreaking because I still go back, because I always say the west side of Chicago is like my family. They were my family. They were there when no one else was there for me,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And when I go into the streets and I check on people that I used to know or hang with or whatever, you know, there's no difference. It's not like, nothing, right? And the thing is that it kind of breaks my heart when I still see them out there struggling or getting worse, and now all of a sudden they're homeless. They used to be like, you know, different, and then
because it never, you know, you're a rare case where the road is up and not down. Linda, how has knowing Bianca and writing her story changed you?
That's a really good question. It's changed me on so many levels.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely look at the city of Chicago differently.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, sure.
You know, I just do. And I understand a lot more about what it really takes to help people. You know, I mean, it's not about institutions, and it's about giving the right resources to the right people, which is something I've kind of always known, but just I have a much deeper appreciation of that. And also, I mean, she's my hero. She doesn't like it when I say that, but it's been a journey for me in terms of just knowing someone that has a life like hers. It's kind of an overwhelming feeling, you know, to see her all the time. And no matter what gets thrown at her, and she's got a few challenges being thrown at her right now, she's a rock, you know. And I don't know anyone, never known anyone like
you that. Also, Bianca, have a few accomplishments. You're about to get a college degree, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm about to get my bachelor degree from Northeastern Illinois University in inner city studies. I only have to pass the math test. Before I came here, I was studying, and I'm going to do it.
You any good at math?
I'm too strong. I can't let this. No, I'm horrible at math. And I have to say to myself, at my job, I do all this elaborate data, right? Like pie charts and graphs and Pivot and Excel, and I'm like really good at it, right?
Yeah.
Like strict,
and they're like
shootings
five
and homicides from Chicago or different places around the world. And the reports, percentage of reduction or this or that. But no one, when I learned my job, no one said the word math. So
I think
it's the thing with math, right? And so now it's like I got this book in front of me that says math. And I'm like, okay, I have to quit college, right?
It just seems to me, and again,
yeah,
I don't
just,
know
I'm
you
just
well,
freaked
but, an
up.
Hour,
but I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it.
I know you're going to do it too.
I'm going to do it. And then I'm going to go on to get my master degree. And I'm still going to just do what I do now. And it's not even about that. It just said, I want to know that when I die, and my Aunt Louise was laughing, and so was my cousin Joanne, because I said, when I die on my tombstone, I want my name, and then I want like B-A-B-S, Emma, and my Joanne and Aunt Louise are like, nobody puts their credentials on the tombstone.
Wait a minute. Who did?
Oh my God.
Someone did. The guy who became a senator here when Ron went.
Here's the thing. My great-great-great-grandchildren, I've let my family down, and nobody looked up to me. So my great-great, a generation of grandchildren are going to go visit my grave, and they're going to say, oh, God, look at great-great-grandma.
You know what
else?
You know what else are going to have this?
Yeah.
They're going to have this remarkable.
I want them to have education.
Remarkable book. Are you I'm not going to say close because it's all relationships, familiar relationships are ongoing. Your relationships with your children and grandchildren are getting better and better.
Mm. Yeah, my little granddaughter, Gemma, she drives me crazy, and she says to me...
Little grandchildren.
Yeah, no, I love her. I love them all, but she's funny, and she does it on purpose. And so she spends the weekends at my house, and then she puts her little hand on her hip. Grandma, I'm hungry, and I'm drinking my coffee like some old hag. And then she's like, Grandma, I'm hungry. I'm like, okay, honey, there's cereal in the kitchen. You know, help yourself. And she's like, well, my other grandma makes me bacon and eggs. And I'm like, okay, well, let me tell you something, sister. That's the grandma you need to go visit, you know.
And just don't tell her you're going out to Forest Park Liquors. Don't
no,
do that.
No, no, no. Bianca, I'll take them out to eat. I'm just not the cook person.
Cannot tell you and Linda Beckstrom how moved and I was by this book and just how good this book is. And I it is a page turner, mm-hmm. and a just sitting there waiting for some cinematic person to
so are we
call Sandra Bullock and say, hey, you're gonna play Bianca.
She'll win an Oscar. I already have it planned out.
Yeah. That's
and I'm
fine.
Gonna be in the
I think
front
she'd
row,
be perfect
like how
for
when
you.
She did The Blind Side. I told Linda, we'll be in the front row, and then Sandra's going to get her Oscar for Best Actress. And then
you'll get up with her.
Well, no, I'll sit there for a minute, and then Sandra's going to put her hand up. She'll be like, oh, my God, I'm so blown. And she's going to look at me. I'm going to stand up, blow the fake Hollywood kisses.
And you'll be crying.
And
you'll
be crying. Yeah, no, I'll be so moved. I think Sandra would do a great job.
So do I.
So if you're out there, Sandra, I need to talk to you.
So do I. Linda, you've done a great job writing this book, and Bianca, you've done an amazing job being honest.
Linda's a brilliant writer.
She really is, but you can't do it alone.
No,
and it's your story and
collaboration.
And being that honest and that introspective is what really infuses
people
this
book.
People
have said to me, come up to me and said, strangers, and said, I cannot believe you admitted to whatever, the different things. Like,
it's not just,
yeah,
it's
no,
not,
and I'm like,
it's not just the admitting the details and the $1,000 this and the $1,000 that and the so-and-so this. It's the introspection. It's the feeling that you, the honesty.
Yeah, I had to tell the whole story. I can't tell how
yeah, but
the
it's
story
hard.
Helps somebody.
I got to tell you something. It's hard to reach that level of honest introspection. Because we're all weak creatures. We are.
Yeah.
Ladies, it will be an ongoing pleasure to know you as I write about you for the Tribune in the coming weeks.
Thank you, Rick.
And thanks for coming in
yeah,
on Oscar night.
Pleasure.
It's probably be the last Oscar night you're free, huh? thank you all for listening. Carla Mari is coming up. I will not be here next Sunday because there's a Hawks game, so I'm not going to watch a rerun of the Oscars either. See you in a couple weeks.
At the Hawks game?
No.
Oh,
I don't go. I've never been to a hockey game. I don't know. I grew up in
this. I was going to ask you to get tickets for my brother, Rich.
I might be able to do that. We'll talk about that.
Okay.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Again, thank you, ladies. Ernie Skatton, thanks for producing. Falling in Love with Catherine O'Connell. Ben Anderson, thanks for producing. And have a great time in New York.